On your knees.
Yeah, pretty much with Peck and me, it's on my knees. That's right. So I did what I always wanted to do in this course. I managed to start a course with two long allusions to William Butler Yeats. I can't do as well now because I'm tired. We've done the whole semester. The best I can do is I can quote a Yeats groupie named Marion Moore, one of his proteges, who wrote an otherwise forgettable poem called The Steeplejack, and said, and I quote, "It is a privilege to see such confusion." And I think that's actually quite true. This is a subject that isn't part of the classic academic canon, and more than that, it's not a subject that I think the society has thought out completely or in detail. It's still under construction. And if you saw some of that construction in the course, I would say that's not a bug, but a feature. Because you don't just watch to learn Homeland Security, you watch to see how people get their arms around problems that they don't understand yet, that haven't been reduced to textbooks. It teaches you how to think about new problems, which is, in the end, the only reason to go to college, right? So what I'd like to do, and clearly after the term papers, you all are done, there's no more competition, no more grading, but I want to ask Jeff to set up one last page about what people think they learned from the course in a very special sense. Some of you will remember from the wiki that I started something like that for computer topics, and maybe Jeff can put that there to sort of put the dollar in the chip in the tip jar, persuade the rest of you to contribute to things you think you learned from the course. But what I'm looking for are specific lessons, things that appear to be generally true. This is a big, confusing subject, and people have a lot of details, and you're sort of swimming in a sea of detail, but no one can think about subjects that way. What you want to know are sort of the big things that are either robustly true or mostly true, because that is the beginning of making models, either mental models that are informal or models that can be mathematical, the way an economist or a physicist makes models. And in the rest of the world, people who aren't in this business, who don't think about issues like this for a living, who don't understand the crowd, say, well, your model only looks at sort of the most important things, but life itself is more complex. And for some reason, this is always directed at social scientists, but in fact, that's the way social scientists do business, that's the way physicists do business, that's the way engineers do business. And the way you fall in a hole is you pick the wrong thing, or the model isn't based on something that's the most important and salient and true thing. But the first thing you do when you look at a course like this is, sure, some of the speakers handed you models with a ribbon around it, and some of those models are pretty good, but you have a whole lot of other interesting facts that you were told. And it's a good time, if you have a notebook like mine, full of things that people said in this course, it's a good time to look back on that and say, what are the odd things that I learned that seem to be true and are vital to understanding these problems, to sort of collect those in one place and think about them. And I think it would be interesting if we had a wiki page for that. And what are the things you think about then when you go from sort of noticing neat facts that seem to be generally true to models? Well, I'm not going to talk all night, but I have two things that I at least get sort of impressionistically about this emerging subject of Homeland Security, because I teach lectures here in order to learn the material, and I listen to other lectures here in order to kind of notice things that make my thinking more coherent and start building a unified theory of the course, which is something that doesn't exist yet, right? At least the subject. That's what we're all building together. That's what we're all going to be thinking about for a while. And the first thing that I notice is that these problems are rich. And what do I mean by that? Well, people make lots of money from grants, they get lots of publicity by saying things like the following. Well, anthrax is terribly, terribly toxic stuff. So if you kind of figure out that, you know, how much it takes to kill one person, and you figure out how many doses there are in a gram, then, geez, some terrorist could go to the top of a building and drop it over the side, and, you know, you'd kill and then fill in the enormous number here. And those kind of arguments are too simple. They prove too much. And one of the nice things about the WMD lectures we had, both from Fitch and from Mueller, is that these are actually kind of difficult things to do technically. And conversely, people say, well, you know, there are terrorists and nobody knows who they are and they can do all these horrible things and it's just a hopeless problem. But, you know, I hope what we got from talking in the early part of the course is that they live in a social and a political milieu. They have constraints too. And it makes the problem more interesting. And finally, in computer security, you know, if you way back at the beginning listen to Jeff talk, it's not true that this is magic and that you know, all sorts of appalling things can happen. Lots of appalling things can happen, but there are constraints. It's an interesting problem. There's a lot to think about. And what I'm saying is that any good model, something that's worth thinking about, the academic slogan is that no tree grows to the sky. All these models have constraints. They're rich enough that you look for the places that, gee, this isn't just going to kill everyone on Earth, which is sort of the thing that will get you in the Associated Press. And then you start noticing what the scarcities are, what the constraints are, what the hard parts of the problem are. And those are the places that for public policy you look to do interventions, right? What are the pressure points in this model that you've built of the world? You build a model of salient facts that you think characterize a particular homeland security problem, and then you notice the pressure points, the places where you could intervene, the clever places, the elegant places. And that's what this enterprise is about. The last thing, you've heard this commercial from me, well, two last things, but you've heard this commercial from me before, but I hope that at least in some of the lectures we've convinced both the social scientists and the engineers that this is a problem that is truly interdisciplinary. It would be nice if we could just sort of walk away from each other and pull down the blinds and talk with our own kind. That doesn't work very well for a lot of these problems. So you had Rick Norman, who came out and talked about building these boxes to cargo screen. And Professor Scotchmer, who was in the room, said, yeah, that's great, but what's your patent policy? You can make these things horrendously more expensive. The job isn't done until they're actually sitting in the port. And so, you know, you'd like to do this as a nuclear physics problem that's clean, that's pretty, but it's not the whole job. And in fact, the project may fail if you don't put it through all the way. And of course, my BioShield lecture tried to make the same point, and the nuclear fear lecture is the same sort of thing. It's not enough just to know the physics of what we know or don't know about radiation, but then we have to say, well, what does it mean to us as human beings? And when are we, you know, sort of giving in to well-known social psychology dynamics? And when are we making sensible normative judgments and, you know, this is how I value it. There's nothing pathological in the society's discussion. This is what we think.
Can I ask you a question about fear, Steve?
Sure.
I keep wondering why we're spending billions of dollars keeping nail clippers off airplanes.
And spending
far less on cybersecurity issues.
But it occurs
to me that one reason might go back to the lectures we've had on what causes people to be terrified. Okay? There's nothing particularly fearsome about the sorts of cyber attacks that one can imagine, and it's well documented that we don't understand ranges that extend more than three or four orders of magnitude of likelihood, for example. So it could be that the product of likelihood and fear factor just doesn't work out in favor of cybersecurity.
Well, and you know, part of that literature says the things that you can imagine that are also dramatic tend to be overrated as risks.
Right.
So, you know, there is sort of a well-understood literature about that. I would actually go a little bit further and say that we actually spend a lot of money, like the nail clipper thing, because we want to avoid certain conversations that we don't like. Our politicians don't like to stand up and talk about the possibility that bad things could happen, although we know that that's the way the world is constructed. They like to pretend, and we like to pretend, and we then reward them for pretending that we can fix problems for all time. But I don't have any problems in my life that get fixed for all time. It would be great, but that isn't the way I do business. Yet as a society, I think we spend a lot of money on some problems because as long as we're spending money, we're doing something and we can feel good about it. We don't have to get to the underlying discussion about these unpleasant possibilities. And for something like nuclear fear, you know, we should have a national dialogue about that. That would bring down the remediation costs one suspects by a great amount of money if we all had a sensible discussion. But instead we have this silence in the society. People who talk about it get punished, and mostly all of us don't talk about it. I actually think, just to get back to what I said a moment ago, that the interaction of social and technological things even extends, and I learned that from this course, to cybersecurity, which is often presented sort of as a formal block diagram CS theory thing. And the thing that was most striking, I just want to talk about two lectures that were particularly nice, but the thing that was most striking was Phil Venables of Goldman Sachs. And, you know, I talk to people very solemnly in the computer science community who tell me that cybersecurity is a deep problem, we don't know how to do it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At least in the world where you pay people enormous amounts of money to live at the office 18 hours a day and you fire them for the smallest infringement, if the incentives are high enough, humans will make cybersecurity work, right? That's sort of a proof that this is not a purely technical problem. He seems to think, and it, I can't judge from the outside, but it was convincing, that, you know, in his world it's pretty well solved, but this is because he's in this place where he has ferocious incentives. At some level you can make it work. It's more a question of what can you make work that with my pay I'll accept.
So that is also interesting to me, because if, you know, we've talked a lot about the contrast of insider threats and outsider threats, and it's pretty clear that in the case of Goldman Sachs, the various snooping that was going on to prevent insider threats winds up being pretty germane to detecting outsider penetrations and threats as well. That is, for decades they've had to worry about insider trading. So they had a bunch of anomaly monitoring to make sure that nobody was doing insider trading. That sort of anomaly monitoring and sort of pattern detection and things like that winds up being pretty useful for detecting penetrations as well.
It does, but the other thing that he pointed out was, and you'll know this phrase better than I will, but you know, all the employees Monday morning get a memo, the following means, whatever that means, are going to be applied by all employees, and they turn around in a rigid body and by golly employ them. And yeah, that makes the computing task a lot easier. If you have people who are as fanatical as the people who actually own the system, and they're willing to do that, and they get punished if they don't, it's an extreme example. But you can sort of mix incentives to make the CS problem easier. And I don't think we want to live in Goldman Sachs world, but that's a tool we should remember is on the shelf, because there are presumably other places where we could make our pure computer science problem a lot easier if we added some social science around the edges in terms of incentives and thought about those things. We shouldn't artificially say, oh, we've come to the edge of our subject, because there are useful things on both sides if we only remember to look. And the last thing that I just enjoyed among the computer science talks was Eric Roscorla, who was talking about how you had multiple populations. You had the people at Microsoft who were churning out patches, and the people who are reverse engineering them for sort of prestige reasons, and then the bad hat hackers who are exploiting that. And that's, you know, if you look at a lot of his data, sort of inexplicable things are happening in there. It has to be that there are dynamics in these communities, and if we understood those better, we'd have, again, information about pressure points, places where you could intervene to solve these sorts of problems in a mixed technical and non-technical sense. So the last thing I want to say has been, I think, a theme for the course. I'm actually pleased at the topics we've taken up, and I think we've said sense about a lot of them, and I think we've said sense about things that you just don't read in the newspapers. And we haven't been afraid to sort of grasp the nettle of things that don't get talked about a lot in the society. And if there's one bottom line thing I'd like you to take away from the course, only you can convince yourself whether this is true, but I want you to take away the idea that going there, thinking about the thing that people avoid thinking about, grasping the nettle, having the discussion, is a good and healthy thing both for you and for the broader polity, and that, you know, you all should go out and agitate to ask those hard questions and think about those things, because avoiding them is nothing but pathological. It produces these silences. We should always be asking the question, are we doing what we do now because it's comfortable and we're tired of the argument, or because it's really the smart and sensible thing to do that spends our resources wisely? And with that, I'm going to turn it back, I think, probably to distribute in the class evaluation forms. But thank you all.
Great. Thanks. Describe what will happen with your white papers. We'll get those graded. We'll get comments back to you. If folks are willing, I think it would be useful to post these on the web for other students. So what I'm going to do is send mail out, and anybody who doesn't want their white paper posted for some reason, let's make it opt out instead of opt in, if that's okay. So I'll broadcast email to the class, but they cover a broad range of topics, and it's not, you know, we won't post our comments or your grades. We'll just post the papers, but I suspect we're going to get a lot of really good information out of people. Okay? We're all set?
Yeah.
Steve, thank you very much. Jeff, thank you very much.
Yep, we're all set down here.
Great, guys. We'll see you. So if I can, let me give you guys course evaluations. And so